some spam email that said, join this PBI list. Hardly baked idea. Where do you think such a thing would originate? How about MIT? So it was this seminar at the AI lab on the orange rug on the floor, and all these partly baked ideas would come out. Who knows what happened? You need a chance to give your partly baked ideas and have them critiqued. So if I were to say, who is the master of partly baked ideas that wind up being deep and profound anyway, it would have to be my longtime colleague and friend, John Mallory. So I give you John Mallory today.
Thanks for that introduction. Usually we apply that to Marvin Minsky. So today we're going to have a recreational talk on a recreational topic, which is sort of hacking the web from Lisp. And it may not be the most polished talk because I had to put it together on the airplane and then the internet wasn't working here. I had some difficulties, but we can make up for that in the interactive session. So we're going to look at the, hello?
Ah!
Oh, it does work. Okay. Try that. Hello? Perfect. Thinking about it. There you go, I have to stand in front of it.
Ah,
no problem. So we're going to look at the CLHTTP web technology, which many people think is a web server, but it's really a whole tool suite. And this is the menu, and there's way too much stuff to talk about, so we're just going to hit some of the high-level points in the front, what's new, a cool hack, and why we're doing it in Lisp, and some of the goals and so forth. And then some brief overviews of the server, the client, and the proxy, and some future directions. And I have in the appendices a set of sort of mini-talks on a variety of topics. And depending on what people want to hear about, we can make it interactive. So I'd like to kind of plow through fairly quickly, maybe then go interactive. If we get excited, we could look at some code or something like that. How about it? So what is in the CLHTTP environment? Well, first of all, it's been around a long time. I was doing a bunch of form-based email processing back in the early 90s. And Tim Berners-Lee came to MIT on January 18th, 1994, and started talking about the web. So I knew I was a loser because I didn't have a web server. So we implemented a web server in a couple of weeks, and then it evolved over the last almost 15 years now to what you see today. It was used pretty extensively in production contexts that I know about, for example, in the White House. And a lot of components sort of improved. So on the one hand, there's the web server and what it can do. In the current version, we generate HTML 4.0 and XML 1.0. We have SSL now on a number of the platforms. We have a presentation system modeled on CLIM that you can use. We have a full text search facility, lots of example code. There's a basic client that basically means a full client implementation minus a UI that you might have on a browser. There's a full proxy server implementation, which actually includes reverse proxy capability. And there's a constraint-based web walker, so you can walk regions of the web and do things with an advanced control structure. And then there's a variety of user contributions. And more or less, that's more or less the package that we're going to be talking about. Come on. So a number of applications have been done with this technology. I'd say most of them have been in the server area. And for many years, it was the only way you were going to do dynamically generated content. So being, in the Lisp world, first thing we think of, in 1994 is, oh, let's have dynamically generated content. So for example, we had standing search URLs on the White House where you click on the thing and it'd tell you what was new today, or it'd tell you stuff by topics. And everything was generated on the fly, all the HTML and so forth. Many years later, now everybody's doing dynamically generated content. There were several hundred applications probably done in research, in universities, and in government and business. The more successful they are in government or in business, the less they tell you about them. So maybe you see the bug report and then you go, ah, somebody's doing something. And so this was originally the interface for this White House electronic publication system, which is a larger list system, about 150K lines of code with lots of AI and so forth. And we had the opportunity or the purgatory of doing an IDEF zero for the whole system. And that's basically building a map of what is the functionality and what are the controls on this whole system. And it turned out to fill a big wall, and it was the most complex system that they ever had in the White House on the civilian side. And the IDEF Zero man told us that, so we were proud of it. And anyway, so whereas the CLHP environment's been handed out since the early 90s, there's been a proliferation, of course, of web servers and so forth, and today there's a lot more fragmentation. There are a lot of various solutions. You can't get everything in one place, and sometimes they're the homebrew servers and so forth. So this is a summary of what was going on in the White House case. We had a partnership between the customers, and they wanted to put out the publications, and the AI lab, and the funder. And lots of interesting things were done, a lot of firsts. This was the first production HTTP 1.1 web server. It was used to debug the W3C reference implementation, because it wasn't doing persistent connections right, and they couldn't figure out why, so we basically single-stepped it from the outside using this code and use the list debugger facilities to figure out why the C code wasn't working. And then they were able to get rolling. The National Performance Review was an interesting thing. It was the first large-scale argument-structured wide area collaboration. There were 4,000 federal workers that collaborated over 10 volumes of National Performance Review documentation, which were sets of proposals and recommendations for what to do, and they could annotate those with an argument-structured link semantics. That was all done in Lisp, and we're going to come back to that topic at the end. That was based on uniform resource names, URNs, which are late-binding identifiers that, in many respects, go beyond the URNs that everybody's familiar with. And anyway, this system, had a nice run for its money, and then there was an election, and it was summarily retired, because we don't need to get the documents out anymore. And then while we were at it, we got rid of the AI lab and merged it into the Laboratory for Computer Science, and moved to a new building, and managed to have the disk drive crashed on the way over. So we spent a couple of years rebuilding the source code and coming up with new infrastructure. And so now we have our own server, which is at chp.org, and it runs on a Mac Mini that was donated by Rainer Joswick. And CSAIL provided us a copy of Mac OS X server to run on it. And Lispburst provided us with a common Lisp to run the site servers. And that's worked out very well. And we're looking to maybe add more capabilities if users in the community want to see things happen there. It's a platform for supporting ideas. There haven't been any funded projects at MIT that rely on this technology, probably since about 1998 or so. So that means that people are going to be working on other projects, and this is really a recreational hacking project. But there might be some new things that are going to happen on there shortly. So, what's happened since the last release? How many people have ever used CLHTP in here? And how many are still using it? Couple people. Okay. Well, if you're familiar with what it did in the last official release, and I don't know if we're going to tell you everything because there are a lot in there, we're going to talk about the increment. So this is roughly speaking the increment from about 2001 to now. So one of the big thing is that we implemented SSL. And so we have a whole portable SSL layer on top. And I guess we have to thank Douglas Crusher from Australia for that, for getting the ball rolling. And then we sort of carried it forward. And the primary platforms at the moment that do a good job on SSL are the Lispworks platform, which does everything, and then the Signer Common Lisp, which is Crusher's Lisp, which does most everything. But we're hoping to see some progress on ACL and SCIM-UCL shortly. But it really does everything you want to do with SSL, and including proxy tunneling and certificate-based user authentication and authorization, which is kind of convenient. You can get rid of passwords, and you can just have them, you know, cryptographically identify the users. It does rely on believing that OpenSSL is actually safe. So you're standing on a pile of C code that may not be so great. But they've certified it, that it, you know, there's this FIPS standard that claims that it's okay, but I keep looking for buffer overflow attacks in the certs, you know, and they keep popping up, so I'm not sure about it. And the other big improvement was in the proxy, so we have our own portable FTP proxy gateway. And then digest authentication, which is required for any you know, web server or client that claims to be HTTP 1.1 compliant, must implement digest authentication. They don't say anything about doing it right. And it turns out that basically every client I could find was doing it wrong. They could not actually do authentication for proxies correctly. So we ended up having to put in a kludge in there to say broken client, then do something different, which gets used most of the time. Assuming they can do it at all, the Safari one just goes into an infinite loop. But you can actually get Firefox to work. And then there's the reverse proxy capability. And before we had SSL, I was doing some, when they decommissioned the White House system, you had underemployed Lisp hackers. And you never want underemployed Lisp hackers because they might write political applications for the other party. So remember that. So we were busy writing political applications for some of the Democratic campaigns, and we ended up running reverse proxies. So we'd have the Lisp application behind Apache, and Apache would do the SSL, and then we'd just go through that. But that's part of the motivation for getting our own SSL going, because it's just more efficient. Another thing we got is generic file copying. So if you're ever trying to copy files, you know, you don't have to necessarily use more primitive methods. And here's lots more stuff. I left out, you know, the lots of bug fixes and all the minor stuff, but we can now generate the modern standards for XHTML or HTML. And these are done with macro packages, which go back to essentially HTML2. And so if you had some code you wrote ever, on this platform, all you would do is recompile your code and it would just work. It wouldn't give you the new capabilities like cascading style sheets, but it would work. There's an RSS 2.0 generation facility in there, and so you can put out your own feeds. There's a new documentation tool that Rainer Yosmig got started, which is called LispDoc. And it allows you to peruse all documentation. And there's lots of it. There's documentation strings throughout the source code because, you know, it's nice to know what it does 5 years after you wrote it. So it's in there for my benefit, but everyone else can benefit from it as well. HTML 4.0 and cascading style sheets have been used throughout all the examples. So there's a lot of example code to see how to set that stuff up. You can even have your own website icons with this ICO image export type. And then the user authentication authorization stuff has been upgraded. In the old days, there was a Lisp machine interface to status. And so the class hierarchy for objects users and access control, all that could be back-ended, you know, into a database, which was status. So that's been done now for MySQL on Listworks. So you can, you know, use a real database to track this rather than a text-based one. And there's a better web interface for dealing with it. And then Karsten Parks come up with a template for rapidly developing new ports, which we need to apply to more lists. Okay, so you guys are all list programmers, so I figured I better put in a cool hat for you up front. So with my laptop here, I can pick it anywhere, and the IP addresses are going to keep changing on it. But I have a web server running on there, which continues to run all the time and always works. So as soon as you connect it, you can access it. And the trick is to use a dynamic DNS provider. And there's free ones like DynDNS. And then what happens is when you come up on the net, the laptop connects to the dynamic DNS provider and says, here's my new IP address. So now your name maps to your new IP address and the people can connect to you. And the trick here is that we set the primary network address on the server to be the loopback address. So 127.0.0.1. And then what we do on the bottom here is we define remappings that remap that internal address to the external address. So you see that on the bottom. So it handles both ways. And this is sort of the kind of technology that you use to do reverse proxies, because you're changing the external names. So with those couple things, you now can run a web server. You don't have to remap any URLs. You don't have to reset any addresses. You don't have to do anything. You just start up your laptop at the new location and it just works. And then of course the SSL is defined with the sort of high level macro. You can't just do enable services because there's a little bit more to it now. There's more parameters to pass in. And so here you see, we are saying what port we want it to run on. We're giving it a certificate and a private key, typically in PEM format. And then you can either feed the password in directly or you can have it prompt is safer. And then you can do actually all the modern, you know, SSLs and ciphers and what have you. So my bright idea was, I'm going to run at, you know, maximum security. And needless to say, you can't do it because the Windows world will lose. I haven't checked the latest Internet Explorer. So the result is you have to run it, you know, toned down a little bit if you want the Windows guys to be able to access it. But anyway, this is the recipe for how to do it. Hello. So here are the goals. So the idea of putting out the list-based web technology was to empower list programmers to, you know, get with the web and be able to do intelligent applications, and to try to create a community around it, and to build, you know, a stable shared infrastructure. But one of the challenges is that even though the list community is fairly small in the web area because everybody wants to do it, it's fairly fragmented, so it's hard to integrate. And that's kind of a problem because everybody ends up having to duplicate the same code, roughly speaking. And I don't have a great solution, but it's something to worry about. So why are we using Lisp? Well, here are a few reasons. It's really one of the best programming languages I think you can get your hands on today. Does what you want. And if you listen to the language theorists, they'll tell you you're standing on 75 years of mathematics and you have clean semantics, and that may be related to, you know, why you can do a good job on these kinds of web applications. I think rapid prototyping and highly evolvable are very important. But in my experience, what I found is no matter, you know, how great the programming language is and how good the implementation is, so that you can design for evolution, which is what you want to do, the inflexible part of the system is the human, because he doesn't want to do it, and even less flexible is the organization who wants to implement change control. So those are sort of problems outside our control. And, So how do you figure it out? Some people have complained that, well, it's too complicated, there's too much stuff. You know, if it was really a one-page web server, they'd be a lot happier. Well, it's about 40,000 lines of code, and here's a strategy for how to figure it out. There's some papers, you can read those. It helps to be aware of the various standards you're trying to deal with. There's a variety of talks that have been given over the years. There's a fair bit of online documentation, including now for the SSL, we have a recipe for how to do your own certificates, which is a bit tricky, so you just follow procedure and it'll work. And now we have this the LispDoc facility, which makes life a little easier, and I should show it to you probably pretty soon. I've mentioned it a few times. There's all kinds of, you know, apropos-ing to be done, the usual, of getting, you know, your function definitions, and a lot of documentation. I think I counted it up one time. Somebody said there's no documentation, and I printed out a lot of it, like a few hundred pages of documentation. and then you can always read the source code. That's what a real wizard does. A real wizard sits down and they read all the source code, one pass, just to get an idea, a sketch of what's going on, and they come back and do it again. That's a good way to wrap your head around it. So let's just see if we can't just take a look at the LispDoc thing. This is a pretty cool feature. We can see that too well. This is the logbook. You can't really see it too well. Let's see if we can make this up. That readable at all, kind of? Make it bigger. Sort of. Okay, so these are the challenges of these talks. I just want to find, see if I can even read it here. Okay. There's a facility like this for Java. I think this is a little bit more interactive. So basically on the top here, you've got a series of packages. So everything's broken into packages. So let's say, you know, you say you want to do RSS. So go to RSS. And then you see some functions and macros here on the left. And so let's say you want to, you know, have an RSS channel. So you do this. And let's see what that looks like. So basically you get the signature and then you get some documentation. So this is one way to approach the problem. Now, you know, quite a bit of documentation. But then again, if you, you know, say you're trying to do, you know, HTML4, oh, we're thinking a lot now, I wonder why. So here, if we scroll through this, you see there's quite a bit of stuff, right? So these are all the external symbols. So let's pick something here. I don't know, say we're defining a script type. So here's the documentation, but there's a lot of stuff and you want to find something. I don't know, what do we want to find? Let's say we want to find, let's see, script. You can type in that apropos. And then it'll show you, basically apply the constraints on the left and show you the callers. Go back. So, look at that. If we could work out a little bit better way to see this stuff, then it would get a little bit far. So, for those of you who aren't familiar with the HTTP too much, these are the main features. There's a bunch of methods that are used. The main one people know about is GET and POST, but you can do, you know, file systems and so forth on it. And the big idea really is the persistent connection and keep the connection alive and go through making requests. And the actual server, this is sort of the characterization. It's all object oriented. it basically exports a URL and binds it to an object, and then you do operations on the object. There's sort of a simple-minded model for accepting user input. It's sort of a simplification of CLIM, and then tied to the types that HTML provides for you. And then on top of that is graphed to the CLIM story, so more advanced. The condition handling, there's all kinds of conditions for all various cases that can come up in sort of the network and in web service, so you can handle conditions. So for example, one of the things that you are only allowed to do is you're only allowed to send 1024 characters in a URL request. Well, some attacks on web servers, they'll send a very large URL and then they'll, try to insert some code there. And so we were seeing that, and what we would do is put a wrapper onto the handler for the condition, which would capture the guy's IP address and send it to the Secret Service. So you could do things like that. There's a sort of a security story really for writing your code in Lisp, which is that you have cleaner abstractions and you can see better what's going on. You differentiate the various levels. There's a story in here about emitting client-side code. We have wrappers. We basically take the mobile code, whatever you're going to emit, and we put it inside an object, and then we have a very well-defined generic function boundary with Lisp, so you don't get it all mixed up in your Lisp code. It's encapsulated, and then you can have specialized methods for shipping it out or synthesizing it on the fly. And the server is highly extensible. So basically the objects are, URLs, condition objects, connections for server and client, then authentication objects. It's a little bit, this is a simple version of what the class hierarchy looks like for URLs. This is a more complex version. So when we added HTTPS, we need the HTTPS classes all to be subclasses of the corresponding HTTP URL classes. So it gets a little more complicated. So it's good to have a development environment. And so basically what's going on in this model is to say that, if you're putting out if you want to serve a request, what you're really doing is calling a function, and that function is going to compute whatever is going to go out. And these are the range of kinds of functions you're going to put out. Maybe static, maybe computed. And generating new code or not, or maybe generating code and then caching it and then shipping that. I guess one of the interesting things is, just like in Lisp, good programming involves defining an embedded language for solving the problem in your domain. Well, the same thing applies here. So if you're doing a good job on your web application, you've defined a vocabulary for problem solutions in that area, so it's easy to extend it and do other things. Here's a little bit on generating web pages. Here's a little bit on the presentation system. How many people know CLIM? Quite a few. Basically, the short explanation is that you have a lattice of types, and you define parsers that accept the input and signal errors if it's misformed, and then return the internal version. And then you have presenters that take the internal version, and then they emit whatever the external version is. So the good thing about it is that the human can interact with what he's used to interacting with, and the machine interacts with what it's good at interacting with. So the W3P presentation system is basically it's sort of a web version of the CLIM presentation system. And so you can do things with it. We intended it to drive dynamic forms, but we never got around to releasing that code. It's lying around still. Move on. You said a bit about mobile code emission. There's a lot of it going out today, and if you want to generate it, you know, you really want to encapsulate it. I don't want to go down that too much right now. So there's a client. The client does everything. So it's something to use. You can use it for communications or RPCs. We have various examples for it. Use the SSL to test the server SSL. Hello? Proxy. Proxy basically does everything and caches data the way you want. You can play with it and use it for doing, you know, URN resolution, shared web annotations, collaborative browsing. We have predictive fetching in there for one of the applications. So this is where we're going. We have a proposal to look at fine-grained security, which basically involves taking the fragment-aware URN work that we deployed in the 90s for the White House to be able to refer to pieces of presidential documents, and basically overhauling that and trying to push it out as network standards and get more uptake, because people really didn't understand that, and they still don't understand how to do fragment references to multiple media types. And you know, it's thought that if you can do that well, then you can enable a class of interactive information sharing applications and wider collaboration. I mean, these can be interoperable by virtue of adhering to these kinds of standards. However, the problem is that nobody knows how to do security for them. They don't know how to set up an authorization system to manage fine-grained security. And so that's what we'd be looking at in this effort if it gets funded. And then if we do that, what's going to happen is we're going to implement the reference code in CLHDP and produce a URN resolver that does all this kind of thing. And so then we'll have some new tools and toys for people to play with. I'll give you a little bit of a picture of what this looks like. Is you basically have these URN resolvers, and it's kind of like Lisp, you know. It's a late binding concept, which says, here I have a name, and the resolver is going to go resolve it for me. And once I do that, then there's a lot of good things that happen. So for example, if I can't get it in one place, maybe I can get it in another place. So I can have higher availability by multi-sourcing. So that's one side of it. And then it's pretty much how that works. You can start playing games with cache notification. You know, maybe you can fetch it out of a cache, and you can have peer-to-peer communication to get it. So there's an interesting availability story there. And then the other side of this is that you can have specialized semantics, too, for your identifiers. So this here is an example of fragment identifiers that we had in the White House system. For the case of text. And since you can have your own namespace, you can stipulate how your semantics is going to work. And so you can make things happen that you can't do with URLs, because URLs are a least common denominator solution. And there's some tricks to make fragment syntax work, which are on the right over here. And there's some interesting things you can do for optimization with delegation on the left. And hello. Ooh, blank. Here's the future, something we've been thinking about lately. So one of my questions to myself was, you know, now you've got OpenSSL running on your website. At least before, people couldn't crack your server, right? Because it's got runtime type checking and it's got buffer bounds checking, but now you've got some C in the loop. And, you know, maybe there's a hole in your C. And so I got worried about that, and I was looking around, and I noticed that OpenSSL's now got a FIPS 140 validation, which means that it's got sort of the NIST good housekeeping seal of approval. So in principle, you could have a Lisp-based server that uses OpenSSL, and you could actually get some certification that it's secure to that level. And then BEA has been working on a web server protection profile. So these are the things that you'd have to do in order to have a secure web server. So just been thinking that, gee, wouldn't it be nice to have that, but then realizing that we, you know, need a couple $1 million to actually jump through all these hoops, so so it might not be anytime soon. But in general, the fact that you have clean abstractions, you know, is really a is an important asset, and abstraction-oriented programming also is going to make it easier for you to write code and do it more reliably. So well, here's a conclusion. We still have a lot of code, and what we really have in the system is a solid foundation for HTTP 1.1 transport. And we could do XML and HTML generation well, and lots of tools. We don't have every upper level feature that you could imagine, because there's so many standards on the web today that, you know, you've got to really pick and choose, unless you're Microsoft and you can try to do everything. But if you have thoughts and ideas and want to contribute something, here's the URL. Now, if people want to, we can ask questions, or we have a sets of sort of an interactive talk. Let's see what they look like. And well, we got, let's see, I'll show you what I got. If people want to do that, you can't get it all, but you might be able to get one of these things. Oops. So we could look at production servers and efficiency, full text indexing, web walking. Try to see some programming examples. I'm not sure I'll display that well. Unless we could look at the availability and port status. That's probably a good one to look at, right? Let's go get that. Yeah, we have to tout the current ports. So you have pretty good availability. So on the top we see a bunch of operating systems. Oops, there's nothing over here on the HP UX11 and i64. That's a Signer Common Lisp item. But yeah, depending on whatever your OS is, there's probably going to be some way that you can run this. So the active ports today, or, you know, LispWorks is, you know, pretty much the solidest of the ports and most extensive. Allegro Common Lisp, the Signer Common Lisp is a new one, and sort of a specialty Lisp. It's a derivative of CMUCL, and Crusher uses it for large scale, you know, bioinformation processing tasks out in Australia. CMUCL is coming along. That's getting better. There's an OpenSSL story happening for that that Madhu has come up with in India, and Rainer's working on integrating it. The Lisp machine story is a little bit behind right now. We haven't got the SSL running there, but you can run it. Potentially one could compile, you know, the OpenSSL and get it to run there. I'm not sure how fast it would be, but possible. Macintosh Common Lisp is sort of having some issues making the x86 transition. Clarice's Allegro port has kind of lapsed. He didn't want to do much on it lately. Lucid Common Lisp port's been lapsed for a while. And we'd like to see an OpenMCL port and an SPCL port. Here are some of the features on the ports. So we got 64-bit capability for those who want it. The LispWorks platform is, you know, very nice, because, you know, you've got an integrated cross-platform interface development environment, so that's pretty good. And we've had great vendor support, which really helps, because CLFT challenges most Lisp. There are lots of, you know, sort of, you know, corner features that you need to have, and if you don't have it, you can't make all of the full feature set work. So we've had great support there. And, you know, and you can also do free apps, so maybe we're thinking you might have a compiled version that we could put out. And it sort of does everything, including certificate-based authentication. The Allegro port, you know, Karsten's been working on it. I'm not sure the latest state of it, but it works. And maybe there's SSL coming for it. Maybe. Shouldn't be too hard. Just got to plug in the Allegro stuff.
But it's working without chunking.
Right now without chunking? So there's some bugs in the chunking code?
when I'm the portable chunking mode.
Oh, okay. So, so there's some issues there. The signer common list is pretty good, and he's got symmetric multiprocessing working on that list. And he runs on some pretty sophisticated hardware. But I don't know how sophisticated the garbage collecting is, so. There's that. CMUCL is sort of coming along. And I guess there's a number of people using it. Anybody here using the CMUCL port? How's it working for you?
It's dormant.
Dormant? So, yeah, so it's not causing any trouble. Turn it off, it's safe. And the symbolic one is, this was the original platform it was developed on. So it was always complete. The main thing it's missing right now is SSL. And it was used in a production environment, so it's high stability. The vendor support was formerly high, but the owner died, so I don't know what's going on there now. So, and the common list port was very extensive as well, but it had this problem where they had some kind of memory leaks, and so you couldn't rely on at the network level, you couldn't rely on the thing staying up forever, but everything else worked fine. And there's that. Any questions or anything else? Yes?
Performance comparison?
Between?
Depends, maybe Java-based servers or what do you have?
I could turn to the slides, but I'll just tell you. Server performance, what you're interested in, right? So if you look at web service, what's really going on? Shipping network packets, shoveling bits, probably from the file system. So the rest of your web server is just control structure. So your main concern is latency. So you can do just fine in Lisp for all those. I would say that comparing this technology to the Java-based servers is probably going to be comparable. The Apache server uses a queuing mechanism, so you can support huge numbers of threads. And Crosher has that available on the SCL platform. So if that's what you want to do, that's the approach to do it. It's something we have in mind for a development issue. But otherwise, you really can field whatever you'd like. There's a number of commercial applications that do Lisp-based servers. One of the more major ones is this company called ITA, which is in the air travel business. And we call it the giant amoeba of Portland Street now, because it's absorbing all possible Lisp packers. And then maybe not much comes out. They're heavily involved in online reservations. Many of the online reservation systems use this big constraint network that they have. And they do some stuff with, baggage handling or gates or something. And then maybe they're working on some kind of reservation system. But it's all done in Lisp, and it all has real-time constraints. So essentially, if you want to do problems like that, you can do it in Lisp. And there's plenty of examples. I think the typical number is that if you work hard, you can make it run within 10% of C. Anybody else? John?
I'm aware there are a number of different other HTTP servers written in Lisp, and I'm only aware of one that specifically had no heritage due to CLHTTP. I wonder if you could comment on the extent of the impact of your early work.
No, I don't know. I don't comment really on okay. Other web servers. Yes.
Can you talk a bit about out-of-the-box experience? Suppose somebody who knows what they're doing wants to put a basic CLHTTP server on a machine just to map some file structure to a fixed URL. How much work is it?
Well, first you have to download it, then you have to start your Lisp. You have to unpack it, and then you have to load the start file.
The start file?
Yeah, and then you just put your files in the directory. In other words, it runs out of the box.
It does. So,
yes. And
so
if it doesn't run out of the box, then shoot one of the port maintainers for giving
so,
it that name.
So what does the configuration look like to say, I want these, this directory and, it, and its tree to go to this URL?
And that URL to be on port 80?
Yeah, for instance. I mean, I know what to do under a patch team. It takes 3 minutes on a fresh machine.
Well, this is pretty simple. This is, you know, it's one.
Port 80.
And you can have whatever port you like. Let's just pick one here. Here. All right. See what that is? Can you see that? Export URL. See that?
Okay. Fine.
Okay. So you got to give it the URL you want. This is just giving it, you know, the host name, but we're doing a 127. You know, load loopback address on this one. Your port, your protocol, it's going to be a directory. We want it to be recursively enumerated, so we're going to go down all the subdirectories. We want to export it immediately, which means do delay automatic exporting. Don't walk the whole structure. So if you have a big one, you don't want to, you want to start up and then you get it on demand. And then we give it a path name. That's where the data is. And then in this case, we're going to give it the authentication realm and the kind of capabilities you need to access it. And that's it.
Pretty sure.
Yeah. Yes?
Is there any support to help write applications that do session management or something similar to what some of the scheme-based servers do with continuations?
I guess we're a little limited on that. Rainer's been threatening to write a real session management tool. We do have cookie facility. So you can do cookies and manage it that way, but you end up having to write it yourself at the moment. Yes?
What kind of license does it have?
It has a whole variety of random licenses. There's licenses from almost anything you can think of, individuals, MIT, what have you. So. There's no really organized license story. Do you have any more specific questions?
Well, if we wanted to use it commercially, would we have to pay anything?
There are lots of people been using it commercially for years.
Okay.
It depends on how much stress you have.
It doesn't really answer the question, actually.
No, it doesn't. Nobody's been sued yet. No, but we're happy to change a license. I figure that for $2,000 a day, we'll go around and try to get everybody to agree to whatever the license should be. It shouldn't take more than a couple of months.
It's $2.
Any other questions? Okay. Well, thank you.